Sunday the 13th of November 2016, 10:45, Service of Remembrance. Bible reading, Micah chapter 4, verses 1 to 5. Talk by Roger Whipp.
The reading is from Micah chapter 4, beginning to read at verse 1. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and peoples will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, so that we may walk in his paths." The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between many peoples and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war any more. Every man will sit under his own vine and under his own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid, for the Lord Almighty has spoken. All the nations may walk in the name of their gods. We will walk in the name of the Lord, our God, forever and ever. And this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Good morning. Many Christians, including myself, battle with the concept of war and aggression. When I first became a Christian 32 years ago, the church I went to then was a pacifist and a member of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. Now, although we got on well, we were great mates, I could not share his view as I considered it necessary to have a strong deterrent. Having spent many years in the police force, one of my hats, or perhaps I should say one of my helmets, was being part of the public disorder team. Having on a number of occasions been in the right situation, having firebombs and other dangerous objects aimed in my direction, I soon learnt that to defeat the enemy, not only did I have to rely on the training, discipline and teamwork of my colleagues, especially when we're in shield formations, but sometimes you had to show some controlled aggression. I can remember being at Notting Hill Carnival, as I was most years during my service, and every year on the Monday evening, a few hundred youths not only want to mug people, but they want to have a fight with the police. On this occasion, things were really getting out of hand. Not only were petrol bombs being thrown at us, but our intelligence gatherers had found out there was a couple of shotguns in the crowd as well. Do you know what? I really didn't want to be there. And if I'm being honest, my knees were knocking. How I wished I could have took off all my riot gear and gone home and watched the TV. But I couldn't. I was paid to do a job and to do it to the best of my ability. Fortunately, after sending up a quick arrow prayer, the rioting stopped and I eventually arrived home tired but unarmed. However, compared to what those we remember today had to go through, my dilemma pales into insignificance. I cannot begin to imagine what these brave men and women, particularly the men, were cannon fodder in the trenches, what they went through. Now, I guess many of them wished that they could have taken off their uniforms and go home. There were some who actually tried to do that. And sadly, they were actually shot as cowards. As an evangelist, I've often been told, "Don't talk to me about your religion. Now, so many wars are caused because of religion. Or comments similar to that. Sadly, the reality is that were done not because of religion, but in the name and disguise of religion. Or by people like Daesh or ISIS have distorted the ideology of their faith. Throughout history, wars have been fought not through the true message contained in their religion, but because of greed, power struggles, etc. Even Christianity, you know, we've had the Crusades and the Spanish Inquisition. Jesus must have wept when they took place in his name. No wonder so many people ask the question, as many do when they're facing dire situations, where was God in this?
During World War I, nearly 900,000 soldiers and 100,000 civilians lost their lives. That's a staggering and horrific 2.19% of the British population at that time. And many more were wounded, often severely. Here in Ypres, one third of the total military losses occurred. And 90,000 of them have no known graves. And so in 1927, a memorial was opened at the Menin Gate as an expression of gratitude by the Belgian population for the sacrifices that were made for their freedom.
On the first night that the memorial was opened, the last post was played as a sign of respect and honour. Since then, something remarkable has happened. Every night at 8 p.m, a small group of men from the local fire brigade close the road and sound the last post. Remarkably, they haven't missed a night since the 28th of July, 1928. In fact, during the Second World War, when Belgium was occupied, the last post ceremony was conducted instead in Surrey. But as soon as Polish forces liberated Ypres in the Second World War, the ceremony resumed, even though there was heavy fighting taking place in other parts of the city. For the population of Ypres, it was important to remember the huge price that soldiers paid to bring them freedom. The Ypres salient is famous not just for the brutality of the fighting, but also for an unassuming Anglican clergyman called Geoffrey Anquetil Studart Kennedy. You probably know him better as Woodbine Willie. So called for his habit of dishing out Woodbine cigarettes to the wounded and dying on the battlefield, as well as prayer and spiritual guidance. The seventh of nine children hailing from Leeds, he was a vicar in Worcester when the war broke out. Quickly volunteering, he found himself on the Western Front, and not shying away from danger, he was often operating in no man's land, armed only with his Bible and cigarettes, and he would fearlessly minister to the soldiers. One celebrated story tells of him crawling out to a working party, putting up wire in front of their trench. A nervous soldier challenged him, asking who he was, and he said, "The church." When a soldier asked what the church was doing out there, he replied, "Its job." In fact, he was awarded the Military Cross at the Battle of Messenim Ridge for running repeatedly into no man's land to help the wounded. The citation said this: "For conspicuous gallantry and devotion to duty, he showed the greatest courage and disregard for his own safety in attending to the wounded under heavy fire. He searched shell holes for our own and enemy wounded, assisting them to the dressing station, and his cheerfulness and endurance had a splendid effect upon all ranks in the frontline trenches, which he constantly visited." After the war, he became closely involved in the Christian socialist and the pacifist movements, touring the country giving public lectures. He was in Liverpool on one of his lecture tours in 1929 when he fell ill and died. A crowd of more than 2,000 turned out for his funeral procession, lining from Worcester Cathedral to his old parish church of St. Paul. They tossed packets of woodbines onto the passing cortege, a gesture the Reverend Studart Kennedy would probably have thoroughly approved of, being a heavy smoker himself. Woodbine Willie was a man who was prepared to put his own life on the line. Motivated by God's love and the message of Jesus, he was prepared to lose his life to bring life to others.
would buy in Willie, a representative and disciple of God. Although now smoking is frowned upon as medical science has discovered its dangers, Woodbine Willie was a man who not only was there to provide spiritual support, but practical support in the hour of need. I think that's a lesson that all Christians need to learn. The life expectancy for those called to the trenches was 6 days. Statistics show that there were only 10 towns or villages in the whole of England who never lost a resident in the First World War. Army chaplains came into their own during the First World War, with its extended periods of trench warfare and the ensuing heavy casualties. For men surrounded by seemingly futile death, a churchman willing to risk his life to join them in the trenches helped them make sense of the war and feel that God had not abandoned them. One mystery to me is why God gives us free will, knowing full well that we're going to abuse it. The world is in a constant battle, a war between good and evil. A battle between God and the devil. You notice the next slide. Look at the spelling. I think it speaks for itself. Today we give thanks and remember those who died that we might be free from oppressive powers and tyranny. However, there is still a spiritual battle going on, and one that we must guard against and fight against. One weapon that Satan uses is the deception, the lie, that all bad things are God's fault. And they give him no credit when good things happen. I want to read to you part of an article extracted from the trilogy entitled The Trumpet Sounds for Britain. And it's written by Reverend David E. Gardner, who went to be with the Lord in 2002, just before the trilogy was republished. While serving in the Royal Navy during World War II, an emergency in a submarine caused him to recognise the miraculous deliverance of God. This personal deliverance later helped him to understand what God had done for the people of Britain as a whole, many times in their history. May 1940 was a time of grave crisis for the British Empire and for the whole world, the whole civilised world. On the 10th of May, Hitler had launched his blitzkrieg against the Low Countries and France. Very soon, Rommel's army, armoured pincer movement, was threatening the British army with encirclement, and our forces were being obliged to withdraw. Back at home, Churchill feared that it would be his hard lot to announce the greatest military disaster in our long history. Whilst on the 27th of May, the German High Command went so far to boast that the British army is encircled and our troops are proceeding to its annihilation. With the entire front collapsing rapidly, the decision was reached at home to evacuate our forces from the continent. But the only port from which the evacuation of the British expeditionary forces was Dunkirk, and that was already being seriously threatened by the Germans. Taking stock of the predicament, Churchill said, "I thought, and some good judges agreed with me, that perhaps 20 to 30,000 men might be re-embarked. The whole route and the core and the brain of the British army seemed about to perish upon the field or to be led into ignominious and starving captivity. All therefore seemed about to be lost. But Britain had a godly sovereign. Seeing the situation developing, His Majesty King George VI requested that Sunday the 26th of May should be observed as National Day of Prayer. In the stirring broadcast, he called the people of Britain and of the Empire to commit their cause to God. Together with members of the cabinet, the king attended Westminster Abbey, whilst millions of his subjects in all parts of the Commonwealth and Empire flocked to the churches to join in prayer. Britain was given inspired leadership in those days, and her people responded immediately when this kind of initiative was taken. The whole nation was at prayer on that Sunday. The scene outside Westminster Abbey was remarkable. Photographs show long queues of people who could not even get in. The Abbey was so crowded. So much so that the following morning, the Daily Sketch exclaimed, "Nothing like it has ever happened before." In its hour of deep distress, a heart cry from both monarch and the people alike was going up to God in prayer. And that cry did not go unanswered. For very soon, at least three miracles were seen to happen. The first was that for some reason, which has never been fully explained, Hitler overruled his generals and he halted the advancement of his armed columns at the very point where they could have proceeded to the British Army's annihilation. They were now only 10 miles away. Later, Churchill asserted in his memoirs that this was because Hitler undoubtedly believed that his air superiority would be sufficient to prevent a large-scale evacuation by sea. This is very significant in terms of the second miracle. The second miracle. A storm of unprecedented fury broke out over Flanders on Tuesday, the 28th of May, 1940, grounding the German Luftwaffe squadrons and enabling the British Army formations, now 8 to 12 miles from Dunkirk, to move up on foot to the coast in the darkness of the storm and the violence of the rain. With scarcely any interruption from aircraft, which were unable to operate in such turbulent conditions, the Fuhrer had obviously not taken the weather into his reckoning, nor the one who controls the weather. And the third miracle? Despite the storm in Flanders, a great calm, such as has been rarely experienced, settled over the English Channel during the days which followed, and its waters became as still as a mill pond. It was this quite extraordinary calm which enabled a vast armada of little ships, big ships, warships, privately owned motor cruisers from British rivers and estuaries, in fact, almost anything that would float, to ply backwards and forth in a desperate bid to rescue as many of our men as possible. Today, although primarily we remember those men and women who have made the ultimate sacrifice, let's never forget the family sacrifices made by serving armed forces personnel. Where is God in their hour of need? Let's have a look at another video.
I think on the sort of five different operational tours I've done, some of them have been more dangerous, more kinetic. People have actively been trying to kill us, as opposed to perhaps more passive peacekeeping type tours. I think throughout, having joined the military with a strong Christian faith, the reassurance, I guess, and the strength that I've drawn from being able to not only express that faith and pray, obviously, and develop that relationship with God, particularly on my last tour, which was amazing, just hearing God speaking to me on a regular basis every morning, being excited about getting up an hour early to read my Bible and to pray, and having the time and space to do that was amazing. And I think, particularly when I was younger and in dangerous, very much in the front line, knowing there were people across the UK and actually around the world who were praying specifically as well as generally for me, meant that even when the rounds were landing quite close, it was I had that reassurance that actually people were remembering me in prayer and that God was looking out for me.
So fear has always been something that I've lived with for a long time, possibly because my own father had many dangerous situations in his military career. So it's something that I've been used to, that fear that Rhett wouldn't come back, that fear of somebody coming to the door, that fear of that fear of being at the end. And so partings are always very difficult. But through it all, God's been very gracious. And there has been a process of a loosening, I would say, of those fears as the years have gone by. Things that would have made me terrified when I was 20, when I was 40, were far less frightening. And a lot of the fears had eased completely, and I'm sure that that was to do with seeing God's faithfulness year on year on year, and my trust in him growing deeper.
When Steve and I first got married in, it was June 1987, I was still in the Navy, working as a naval nurse, but based in Portsmouth, and Steve was weekended to Plymouth. We knew that it wouldn't be that long before we would want to start to have a family. And at that time, if you became pregnant, you left the Navy, you didn't have the option to stay on. So for a little while, I did do some agency nursing. I carried on with my nursing. And our eldest child, we've got two boys now, our eldest child was born in 1989.
I remember one little story when we were operating up in the Ice and Faroes Gap during the Cold War, and we would go up there for sort of 2 months, six, eight weeks at a time, and we became like the submariners, and we were very limited in communications, and we had what they call family grams, which were 20 words that you could send weekly. No, monthly.
Monthly.
20 words, and that was it. Just a quick message home. And I was wondering, what on earth can you put in 20 words? And I suddenly had this bright idea that if I strung together 20 Bible verses, I could say quite a lot. So I went through the Bible and found 20 Bible verses, so we ran them all together, like John 3:16 was one word.
Song of Solomon came in handy.
Song of Solomon was in there quite a bit. But I took my family gram up to the main communications office, the first one. Then I was summoned by our security and intelligence officer, who thought I was operating some weird and wonderful code back to the UK at the height of the Cold War. But once we'd established that these were actually Bible verses, a lot of the lads were asking me to provide them with Bible verses, mainly from Song of Solomon, back to their families.
It was Steve's last deployment, and 3 weeks before he was due to go away for a six-month deployment, I had to go to the doctors, and on seeing the doctor, I was immediately admitted to hospital for various investigations, because they were trying to find out whether I had cancer or not. And they made no bones about it. They said, this is what we're looking at. The one thing that I found so helpful was I had a CD, and it was the song Dear Lord and Father of Mankind, but it was a slightly different arrangement done by Tim Hughes. And it was the phrase, take from my soul the strain and stress and let my ordered life confess the beauty of your peace. And in the hospital, I played that over and over again, because when it came down to it, that's all that was left. It was no use worrying about what may or may not happen. Mm. And it was, I just got an incredible sense of peace, because God is the one that can give that.
And we believe it was a miracle. The lump just vanished, and they could have no explanation for it.
The fact that we both had a strong Christian faith, without doubt, that has helped us get through, right from, you know, the first time we were separated, all the way through. Because that, there have been difficult times. But there's been that fundamental knowledge that at the time, this is where God wants Steve to be. And knowing that is what has enabled us to get through.
I was quite scared about joining the RAF. I didn't really know what that entailed. I knew that people went away a lot, and I knew, you know, what I'd seen on the news, really, that, you know, there was quite a lot happening in terms of wars and things, and you saw regularly people being reported of being killed and whatnot. So, yeah, it was quite a terrifying thought at first.
There was this one time when I was Skyping the kids, which is amazing, something we never had, obviously, when my dad was away. Skyping the kids one evening from my room in Kandahar, and we came under rocket attack, and the alarm started going, and obviously immediate actions are immediate actions. I didn't have time to stop the Skype call before I carried out my drill. And so the kids saw a bit of that, and then I just kind of went, oh, I'll speak to you later, and signed off. And I think that left you with a bit of a tricky situation, didn't it?
Yeah, there was that moment of, oh no, what do I say to them, and what happens next, and yeah. Certainly, I take a lot of strength from being a Christian and trusting in God, that he has a plan for our life, and that he wants the best for us, and that, yeah, that it is all in his plan. And I quite often, when I'm praying and things, when Johnny's away, will feel a sense of peace just about the situation, and strength that certainly isn't my own. I'm generally inclined to worry about things, and quite often I'm not overly worried when he's away and things, and that's definitely not me, that's God filling in the gaps where I can't do it.
For me, I just find it so important to just keep in mind what's happened before and the sacrifice that these guys have made. Because if you don't, and remember that the huge sacrifice, particularly the First World War, I mean, the percentage of the country that was affected is astronomical. And if you don't remember that and continue to remember that, then one day you'll find yourself, as a nation, as a world, back in the same position, doing the same thing.
I think it's good to remember what's been. It's very easy to take for granted what we have, and even now, sort of the situation and the wars we're in now, it's very easy to sort of just think very lightheartedly about it, and that it doesn't really affect us and things, but it will always affect us. That the wars that we're in, you know, will always have an effect, and certainly things like the First World War had a huge impact on our lives, and the people that did that should never be forgotten. They should always be honoured, really, for how brave they were and what they did sacrifice.
The several things that I want to highlight from that video clip. Confirmation, how important the Word of God is. Not just for sending coded messages. And for those that don't know, the Old Testament book, the Song of Solomon's, is the most erotic book in the Bible. Who says that the Bible is dull and boring? Challenge you, get home and read it. Also, there's a recognition that although the Christian faith doesn't exempt anyone from the dangers faced in war, faith in God can give the peace that passes all human understanding. And then finally, although Britain's involvement in the Vietnam War was confined to just an advisory and a minor logistical role with no troops on the ground as such, I want to conclude this talk with a story from
the Vietnam War, where was God? Probably one of the most well-known pictures to come out of the Vietnam War was Nick Utz's Pulitzer Prize winning photograph of Frank Thoi Kim Phuc, which I hope you'll see in a minute. On June the 8th, 1972, a napalm bomb was dropped on her village. And Kim, who was just 9 years old at the time, ran crying from a hiding place in the village temple in Vietnam. Phuc's arms were outstretched in terror and pain. And skin is flapping from her legs as she cries, "Non qua, non qua, too hot, too hot." Doctor said Kim would never survive. But after 14 months in the hospital and 17 surgeries, she returned to her family. However, despite her physical recovery, Kim was seldom free from pain, nightmares, and anger. As Kim tells her story, she says, "The anger inside me was like a hatred, high as a mountain, and my bitterness was black as old coffee. I hated my life. I hated all people that were normal, because I was not normal. I wanted to die many times. Doctors helped heal my wounds, but they couldn't heal my heart." Then Kim found a Bible while spending time in the library. It confused her because it was so different from her religion. But her brother-in-law had a friend who was a Christian. She arranged to see him and took a big list of questions. And after they talked, this friend invited Kim to visit his church for a Christmas service. The end of the service was a turning point in Kim's life after 10 years of pain. "I could not wait to trust the Lord," Kim said. "Jesus helped me learn to forgive my enemies, and I finally had some peace in my heart." In fact, 14 years later, she met the man who was responsible for setting up the airstrike on a village in Vietnam. His name was John Plummer, and he had approved the strikes after he was twice assured there was no civilians in that area. In 1996, he was the pastor of the Bethany United Methodist Church in Purcellville, Virginia. And he had learned through a network news story that Kim was alive, living in Toronto, Canada, and she was about to speak at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. Plummer invited members of the Vietnam helicopter flight crew to attend the speech with him. And as Kim Phuc addressed the crowd, she said that if she ever met the pilot of the plane, she would tell him she forgives him. And that they cannot change the past, but she hoped they could work together in the future. Plummer was introduced to Kim Phuc that day and later wrote about the meeting in the Virginia Advocate. "She saw my grief, my pain, my sorrow," he wrote. "She held out her arms to me and embraced me. All I could say was, I'm sorry, over and over again. At the same time, she was saying, it's all right. It's all right. I forgive. I forgive." Today, Kim is an author and she travels thousands of miles to spread the message of love and forgiveness through Jesus Christ. She tells her audiences, "Now when I look at my scars and suffer pain, I am thankful the Lord put his mark on my body to remind me that he is with me all the time." In a word, Kim is a world changer. When she trusted Christ with her life, God changed her from the inside out and then started using her to change the world. She moved out from the valley of depression to a mountaintop experience when by God's grace and anointing of the Holy Spirit, she was able
to forgive. If only forgiveness and acceptance replaced retaliation and bitterness, what a better world we would all live in. Can you imagine a world where we all followed the teaching and the example of Christ? And let us never forget that Jesus, as he also made the ultimate sacrifice, asked his Father in heaven to forgive those responsible. True, meaningful forgiveness is never easy, but it's essential to bring an end to hostilities. There would be less wars if forgiveness replaced retaliation. Today's reading spoke of a day when all people will come to and climb the mountain of the Lord. It's a prophetic word, and although no date is mentioned, how I long for its complete fulfilment. The time when God will reign supreme over his perfect kingdom, bringing an era of peace and blessing. When war will be forever ended. Just as Kim learned to forgive and gain peace in her heart, today, so can you. Maybe you have been holding on to physical or emotional scars, and you need to give them over to God and to receive the healing balm of Jesus Christ. Maybe there are things that you did or you said to someone that offended God. Just like Kim Fook, God is waiting there, his arms outstretched to embrace you, saying, "It's all right. It's all right. I forgive. I forgive."